Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Blaser, the owner and lead writer of Game Wisdom. Ken couldn't make it this week, but fortunately, I am joined by returning guest. He is the lead designer and owner for Arkhan Games, Chris Park.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yep, Chris, it's great to talk to you again. I know it's been a few months since we last spoke.
Yeah, I think we're getting rather periodic about this, huh?
Yeah.
I keep coming out with new stuff, so there's always something new to talk about, I guess.
Yeah, and last year, would you guys just keep releasing a game every month or two? We were just having you on, like, every few weeks.
Yeah, that was a busy year.
And we'll definitely be talking about your latest game and what you just released later on in the cast. So, I want to start with some game news, but unfortunately, there really wasn't any big news or anything interesting to talk about. So I figured we could go to a tried and true topic for the Perceptive Podcast, and that is Dark Souls. As we know, Dark Souls 2 was released, I believe it was just this week by the time this recording goes up. And I know before the cast, I asked Chris if you actually played any of Souls games, and you played Demon's Souls, right?
Right.
And that's cool, because I've been playing all three, and I didn't want any innocent bystanders to get in the blast of this.
Yeah, I maybe have 15 hours or so into Demon's Souls, so...
And it's kind of interesting with Demon's Souls and the progression. I know the series originally started, I think it was King's Bounty, King's Field. I think that was sort of like the original series of it, which I never played. I don't know if you ever checked that out.
No, I didn't. I think it was mostly Japan, wasn't it? My impression was that it was an unexpected port to the United States with Demon's Souls, and then definitely an unexpected hit over here.
Yeah. Demon's Souls was kind of funny like that. It was originally published by Atlas, who Namco Bandai took over with Souls 1 and 2. And it had, like, no, like, marketing over here. No advertisements. The only thing a lot of people knew about was, I think, Famitsu gave it, like, almost a perfect score or close to it. And that sort of got the buzz going about, hey, have you heard this really hard game that's coming out? And then it just, you know, blew up over here. I mean, Dark Souls 2, I actually saw a TV commercial for that game, and I just can't, you know, fathom how we're having, like, a casual television commercial for a game like Dark Souls. Like, the two don't really seem to mix in my head.
Yeah, that sounds like, you know, like, hey, coming into my store, and you walk in the door, and there's, like, a claymore mine that goes off. I mean, it's just like, oh, you didn't expect that. Yeah.
So, with Demon's Souls, as a designer, I'm just wondering, what were your thoughts on the game? Because, obviously, it has a very unique design philosophy.
For me, with the first one, it was something that I found very frustrating at first. You know, before you really kind of get the feel of that first level. And so, you know, I spent a long while there. But, if there's something compelling enough about it that, you know, I spent several hours, like... beating away on this. I'm like, you know, I haven't really done this since I was a kid. You know, back in the, you know, Atari or early Nintendo days or whatever, I mean, we were all less skilled, we were way younger, etc. You know, and we would just bang on the same level over and 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 over again, you know. And that was something that I was like, wow, this feels familiar. I haven't done that in like 15, 20 years. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, this is old school in that way, and I kind of like that. This is a challenge for me as an adult, like a lot of stuff was a challenge for me as a kid, and that was kind of cool in a nostalgic way. And then I kind of passed this threshold, and I was like, this is really different, because the feeling of tension that was created was just unreal, and I really like Silent Hill games, not all of them, but I mean, Silent Hill 2 is like my third favorite game ever. And there's a certain kind of tension there and just kind of this existential horror. But I felt like Demon's Souls went beyond that, where it wasn't horror, but it was just, it really made me feel at one with that world, because you're there with your terrible equipment and your terrible weapons and stuff. And it's like, this must be what it would actually feel like to be on an adventure like this. I mean, there's a bunch of orcs and whatever, and you don't feel like Superman who can't die or whatever else. You're feeling like you're very mortal. You're keenly aware of your mortality the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and with Demon Souls, I think they kind of emphasize that with the way that you could handle the loot, where it's like, do I take this and run back to the point where I can save and, you know, mm-hmm. keep my loot, or do I risk going further, you know, or am I constantly running back to the start like a little girl, you know? And, you know, and then those whole runs where it's like, okay, you died, and then let's see if I can go get back to my corpse before it mm-hmm. disappears. And, of course, now I don't have the equipment that I had before when I got killed at that place that I'm now trying to get back to. And so it's just like, that was just a kind of perfect storm for me of just really clever design elements that came together to really provide just a unique emotion and mood and setting that and level of immersion that I just find to be unmatched. And then I hit a point where I was like, that was great. I really enjoyed that. I got my money's worth. I'm like three areas in, and I don't personally need any more of that. I mean, it's bloody-minded hard.
Yeah.
I mean, and I was like, you know, there's other things that I would rather do at this point, but gosh, that was awesome while I was doing it. And so I haven't, you know, gotten into the next one because, like, oh, you know, I really like the one, but I just, mm-hmm. I don't feel a need for more.
Yeah, like, did Sora feel like, I guess the while it used, it just feels like a very exhausting game to play.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if I had that was one of the things back in the day, too, like, with, you know, the original Nintendo or whatever, you know, you had, like, six games, you know, and they were expensive. And, you know, you'd get one, like, a couple times a year or whatever. And so, you know, like, Zelda 2, for instance, you know, be playing that thing and, you know, losing, and then come back and play it again and so forth. And so it didn't matter that it was exhausting because, you know, it's exhausting, then fine. You stop playing games for a while and you go play outside.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, another day or whatever, you come back and it's like, well, you know, I beat Zelda 1. I can play that again, and that is fun. You know, I can play Super Mario 3 or do whatever, but dang it, I want to beat Zelda 2, you know, and so you go back in, and despite the fact that it's this exhausting thing, you're kind of self-moderating, I guess. But now there's just, you know, nobody has six games. I mean, you know, there's nobody even has six games that they own that they have, I'm saying this wrong, but, you know, our backlog of games we haven't even loaded up yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thanks to Steam and stuff, is, you know, well over six games for Inga.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, there's no incentive to go back to the bloody-minded ones where it's just like, you know, you're beating your head on a wall, mm-hmm. unless that's really your thing. And for the people who that's really their thing, awesome, go mm-hmm. for it. And I should say, you know, that I think that AI War, you know, and some of my own games are the same sort of thing. I think a lot of people look at that and go, that was entertaining for what I played of it, but good God, who would put in 600 hours into that? You know, that is something that I just can't fathom doing. But then it's like, you know, the people that play that sort of thing, and you know, that includes me, it's like, yeah, okay, you know, 600 hours, whatever. You know, I started getting tired of AI War after I think I had around 4,000 hours into it, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, it's you know, it takes the right sort of mindset for the right sort of person, I guess, or, you know, the fighting games that people put just insane numbers of hours into, and I can't fathom it. So it's just
mm-hmm.
there's sports games, you know. It it's just there. People find a specific thing and just will, if they're really into it, they'll just go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that presumably, you know, Dark Souls and Dark Souls 2 and all that sort of thing scratches the itch for those sort of people, and that's perfect. I mean, that's serving its purpose as far as I'm concerned, but trying to kind of you know, attract the entire market with Dark Souls or AI War for that matter seems to me to be a precarious position. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, for me with sports games, I can't play those games. There's few genres out there that I just cannot fathom or enjoy. I think I told the story on a previous cast, but pretty much my entire football playing career was pretty much 1 month in 2001. That was the last time I ever played an actual football game. And then all of a sudden, after that 1 month, I was like, nope, I have no desire to play this ever again. I had my fill. Never again will I touch a football game.
I used to play the ones on the regular Nintendo. I mean, like, RBI Baseball 3 was really good, and I forget everything. It was Tecmo Super Bowl was really fun. And I used to really like NFL Blitz, the first one, because it was just ridiculous, you know. And that one was just, like, so incredibly over-the-top, ridiculous, and arcadey. And, I mean, you know, you're, like, suplexing people and stuff. That was fun. And occasionally, like, I'll get into a golf game or something. But it's just like, you know, for the most part, no. And they tend to be arcadey because the more serious they get, the more I'm like, this is getting out of my level of interest, you know. And I found that I'm not one for watching sports either. You know, I was always playing sports. You know, I played tennis. I played track and field. I mean, I used to play tennis 2 hours a day, 6 days a week in high school. And, you know, sports were a big part of my actual life doing them, but watching someone else do them or doing it virtually, I don't know. That just never really was like a thing for me.
I'm curious, do you enjoy watching like Let's Plays or like esports, like watching other people play video games, or are you of like the same mind like as you feel sports?
It really depends. I don't do a whole lot of it, but when it's something, they're the superstars or something like that for like the Mario games, where they've got these people that are able to navigate the levels just perfectly, and they just fly through those levels. I really enjoy seeing that. It just gives me such a feeling of satisfaction. And sometimes when it's a game that I am unwilling to invest like Demon's Souls, you know, past a certain point, I'm just unwilling to invest the kind of effort into learning it. I think it was I Want to Be the Guy. You know, I played that, you know, some. But then I enjoyed watching videos of other people playing that and winning, and that was really cool. You know, and then I enjoy watching Let's Plays of people playing my own stuff from time to time because I get to see kind of what they do and how they're doing things differently than I expected. And, you know, that's a whole different level of that. That's more study, but it's still pleasurable, but it's more of a study thing than something that I would just do for recreation with somebody else's game, I guess. So, you know, I guess it's hit or miss with that.
I think the one that I like to watch is when they show the Evo tournaments or the fighting game tournaments on, they stream that. Because I can never play fighting games at that level. And it's just so fascinating to watch, like, super high level, like, Street Fighter play or Mortal Kombat or even something like Marvel versus Capcom, which it's insane just how much of a difference there is between two normal guys playing these games and then, you know, the people who've, like, practiced and trained for hours and hours playing the same exact game.
I used to enjoy playing, like, Mortal Kombat, Street Fighter 2, One Must Fall 2011, and some of the other stuff, but I just can't follow what's going on. You know, like, even on the games that I used to play, I'm like, I don't even know what you're doing there. Like, why did you move back, and how the heck did you pull off that combo, and, you know, why exactly is this strategy a good one? You know, like, I don't feel like I understand what's happening at a fundamental level. And I, like, with the Mario stuff, I'm like, okay, I see exactly how you're timing. And part of it is I'm nowhere near at that level, but I'm a really good Mario player. And so, you know, I get a sense for the course layouts, and, you know, I enjoy doing speed runs and that sort of thing, and I appreciate how much better they are at it than me, but I still fundamentally understand what's going on with everything that they're doing. And I think for somebody that was better at fighting games, there would be that same level of satisfaction. But for me, I never really reached even that level at fighting games. So it's just kind of like, I just don't follow, you know. You know, I know the buttons, and I, you know, you tell me the combo, and it's like, okay, you know, and I know the common combo swipes and all that sort of stuff, but it's just kind of like, you know, I don't have any sense for what does more damage or less or what a good combo would be or whatever. You know, I'm just kind of flailing and or doing the few combos that I know and trying to dodge, you know.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy, like high level. I mean, I hear terms, you know, like frame canceling, you have to punish this move, you have to...
Oh, I know.
Guard, reversal, counter, and I'm just sitting there going, what? I could
now. I have enjoyed reading about that and so forth, and having some people break that down. I was like, that is fascinating, and I have enjoyed reading about that because I can follow it when it's freaking written. But oh man, just like watching it in real time. Yeah.
The example for me would probably be StarCraft 2. I used to watch like games play of that. Like, I could definitely do that. And then like go on to like a rank match and just get horribly killed and was like, done, never want to play this game again, uninstall. Like, it was just too depressing to play StarCraft 2 after just like losing like 10 games in a row.
Yeah, I used to play Empire Earth online and Age of Empires 2 online. Some, and, you know, in the open stuff versus just, like, peer-to-peer with friends. And that was really hit or miss because you could get some people that it's like, I mean, I remember the one glorious triumph I had in Age of Empires 2 where I snuck some Persian war elephants down around the side of the lake and just, you know, really salvaged a bad situation. And that was, like, the crowning moment of my RTS online career, and I kind of hung it up after that, just like, I'm never going to top that, you know. And, you know, that was against somebody who was a little bit better than me, but I managed to catch him off guard. And, you know, but then there's just these other times where it's just like, here comes the people rolling you, and you don't really quite understand why, because you couldn't see what they did.
Yeah. And if we're talking about RTS high marks, I guess mine would be when I play Command & Conquer Generals. I actually won a 2-1 as the air general. I guess my partner got wiped out, so I just had to finish these two guys off by myself. And after that game, I was like, I'm never going to do anything better in any real-time strategy game. I got to call it now. This is the end of my career. It's never going to get better.
Yeah, there's always that moment you realize.
Okay, bringing us back to Demon's Souls, one thing that I wanted to ask you, Chris, regarding the first level, or I guess what the title, World 1-1, I find that to be very interesting in terms of level design. I have a post I'm writing about that probably this week or next, and I found it to be just a perfect like microcosm of all the mechanics that Demon's Souls is going to test you by. And I'm just wondering, from a design point of view, what were your thoughts on just how that level was set up, if you can remember those?
Yeah, it's been 4 years, but I remember it well, because I played it so many times.
So many nightmares.
Yeah, I mean, that was, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, because honestly, I didn't play through the full game experience, and so I didn't have a sense of if there were still going to be more mechanics introduced, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the thing that did stick out to me, you know, from what I did play was just how, they really gave you a sense of, okay, there's stuff off to the side that clearly outmatches you. I mean, there was that one place where you could go to the right and there's like a tower and you're like, oh, there's a dude like way off there on, I think, a horse or something. And you're like, let's maybe approach him carefully. And then he like comes riding at you. And if you don't like run like the wind, he murders you immediately. And it's like, oh, okay, so that sort of thing happens, you know. And then there were just all these things where, you know, the most direct path was not smart, you know. There's archers after you, and you have to kind of double back and things like that. And I really appreciated that sort of thing because it lets you blunder forward in the most kind of cliche way. Mm-hmm. You know, like, as a gamer, we're trained to do certain things. And they were saying, not here, you know. And so you would do the thing you were trained to do repeatedly, and you would kind of gradually come to this realization of, I see what's going on here. This is why this is not working. Mm-hmm. What else is around? There's, like, stuff on the ground and, you know, oh, look at those boxes that are behind me. What if I retreat to there first? Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, archers didn't, like, completely murder me. I have a moment to think. That's nice. Huh. What can I do? Hey, the archer's coming this way. Oh, I didn't know he'd do that. You know, okay, well, now what do I do? Well, he's closer. I'll run up and kill him, you know. And so it's just like, okay, wow, this is, you know, these kind of revelations. And then, you know, things kind of start slotting into place. You're like, I get it. Oh, you know. Yeah, hang back and do these certain sorts of things and, you know, look for cover and, you know, it's like some of that stuff seems obvious, but, you know, in other games, it's all about moving forward and finding cover or doing things of that nature, you know, and you want to kind of you know, always have that momentum. And I think there was this one part where you could jump over a wall to the left and go into this really nasty courtyard mm-hmm. with these really bad guys,
yeah.
or you could run straight. And I found you could jump over that thing and then just, like, just take off like a shot, you know, mm-hmm. and get away from those guys, make it around a couple of corners, and that was actually a good way to do it, because if you went straight, then you get these kind of moderately, you know, and this
yeah.
just all that sort of stuff. And that was really interesting to me because it was just really different in terms of patterns, and it kind of shaped a different way of thinking about things. And that's part of what made it feel like it wasn't like, oh, these guys have, you know, 1,000 hit points. Mm-hmm. I have to, you know, hit him 100 times, you know, to make him go down, and I have to dodge properly, mm-hmm. you know, 100 times to make that work. It's not like a reflex test per se, even though that is involved.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a new way of thinking about the space that mm-hmm. you're in. You know, normally you'd think about this sort of space this way. You're going to think about it this way now, buddy, or you're going to die, you know. And that was actually something that I feel like my own game, Valley 1, did somewhat. And that was kind of inspired by Demon's Souls, really. Like, you know, we took the whole thing with, you know, players are used to exploring everywhere. And we said, look, that's stupid. Don't do that. We'll make these big things and we'll give you these maps that let you kind of home in on what's important. And we kind of met some, there were a lot of people that really connected with that. Then there were some other people that were like, but I feel compelled to, you know, mm-hmm. do everything. And that's so boring. And we're like, yes, that is boring. Don't do that. You know? And so it's just kind of interesting because I felt like what they were doing in Demon's Souls can be cross applied to other things and other genres. You know, we did a very, very light bit of that with Valley 1, but it's just, it's such an interesting concept of taking the cliches of something that, you know, just the expectations that have been built up and then saying, okay, that's cliche. Go ahead and try that. See how that works out for you. You know, and here's something much more clever. And I think other indie games, various ones, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but there are various ones that exploit that really well.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And Supe, you haven't played the other two, Dark Souls 1 and 2, because I'm really curious to see what people think about that. Because Demon's Souls, to me, I consider that to be the high mark of the series, just in terms of combination of design, storytelling, and just like the general aesthetic of how each world was set up. And I guess it also sort of lean to what game that I've been playing this week, which is, of course, Dark Souls 2. And when I played the original Dark Souls, I just felt that some of that magic was lost in the move from Demon's Souls to Dark. And generally, just how the enemies were set up. As you said, in Demon's Souls, your progress wasn't always, you know, a straightforward momentum. You had to take time. Sometimes you had to go a different way. But there was, generally speaking, something you could do other than just, you know, running straight at the guy and hoping this time it works.
Right.
With, like, Dark Souls, and especially with Dark Souls 2, what I'm finding is that the challenges aren't as creative this time around. And I'm going to be talking about this in my review, which, at this point, it's going to be probably a small book, and already at, like, 3,000 words for just the first part of it. And a lot of the bosses just fall into the same pattern of, let's have the guy run at you and hit you with wide attacks. There's, like, none of that creativity from Demon's Souls of how there were bosses like the Tower Knight, you know, this giant guy.
Oh, yeah. That guy was cool.
And then archers you had to deal with. Like, mm-hmm. it felt like there were generally different ways to fight these guys, but then they each had their own unique, essentially a test for you to accomplish. With Dark Souls 2, from what I've played, I've fought 6 bosses so far, and all of them just follow the exact same general pattern of combat. Which, it's hard in the beginning when your character isn't leveled, but then once you get to, like, sort of like that point where things start to break through, it's now getting a little bit boring, which is definitely a strange thing to say about these types of games.
Yeah, that, it's one of those, I mean, that's one of the tricky things. I mean, I can say that as a designer.
Mm-hmm.
When you have something that is a particularly clever concept, but that's kind of limited in scope,
mm-hmm.
There's only so far you can push that.
Yeah.
Like, Bionic Dews, I'm really proud of, and I think we could do a solid expansion for it Maybe two. Mm-hmm. But if we tried to do like a sequel or something and we didn't add like something really major that really switched things up, mm-hmm. You know, the cleverness is either repeated or just gets
lost,
you know,
in the shuffle.
Just lost in the shuffle, or just stretched too thin, mm-hmm. or just you wind up going with stuff where it's like, well, that's not clever anymore. I've seen that mm-hmm. before. Or, you know, and there's, I can't comment one way or the other on Dark Souls 1 or 2. And I don't like to criticize other developers, but I felt like Demon's Souls was just, it really was so uniquely creative mm-hmm. that I could see them, I could understand why a studio might run into a problem where the cleverness factor of one particular franchise just gets kind of mined out.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, when that happens, it's like, well, it's time to do something new. But mm-hmm. when you're a major studio,
and you have like a big hit, it's very hard to, you know, say, let's not make the sequel to our game that sold, you know, $10 million. You know, it sold hundreds of millions of copies, you know, the Call of Duties, the Halo, stuff like that.
Right. But, I mean, there are examples of that happening, mm-hmm. like, you know, Ico, or what was the one that followed that?
Shadow of the Colossus?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everything in Shadow of the Colossus was so clever with mm-hmm. the bosses. I mean, it's kind of like what you were talking about with Demon's Souls 1. But, I mean, I did not feel a need for a sequel there either, because I just had the sense that it was like they held nothing back.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. They did it. And, you know, there hasn't been a sequel, and I feel like that's almost good, you know?
Yeah, like, they basically got everything they want in that first one. There was no, you know, to be continued. There weren't really any story threads left to be explored. They just did everything they want with that first game. I think it was an example of like something that was perfectly encapsulated in that one experience.
Mm-hmm.
I think another thing people have been talking about would probably be like the show Breaking Bad, which I think is another good example of that. That's a show that they left nothing. I doubt they're going to make, you know, a sequel to that show. They're going to do like a spinoff slash prequel, but they basically told that story, and I think that story is, you know, done. It's in the ground. Like they've done everything they can with that plot.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes sense. And there's, you know, a lot of the best shows, they go out, you know, when they're done, you know. I'm still catching up on Burn Notice, which is a favorite of mine. We're 3/4 of the way through the next to last season, and it's not something that's gotten tired out for me, but it's something where I feel like, you know, they've built things new all the way through, and they've discarded, you know, tropes. They haven't fallen into that kind of pattern of let's do the same thing a million times, mm-hmm. and that they are going to exhaust everything that they can possibly do within the next, you know, season and a quarter or whatever, mm-hmm. and then that's it. And it's like, that's a masterwork mm-hmm. when that sort of thing happens. Breaking Bad or, you know, Shadow of the Colossus or whatever, we remember those things really fondly. And then if you try, you know, you get like 101 Dalmatians 2 or 102 Dalmatians or whatever it is. You
just
know,
like insert any like Disney movie sequel.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. And I've never seen them, so, you know, but it was pretty clear what the deal was with those. I saw the Aladdin sequels. Those were bad enough, even as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's just sometimes there's just shouldn't be more.
Yeah. I think it's interesting when you pulled up like examples of like Bionic Dudes, and like with these types of games, because they're set up to be like a procedural or randomly generated, I mean, you can always add in new stuff to it. But as you said, to try and make a sequel to that, make something completely separate from that experience, but in the same vein, like as you said, you can sort of run into like the sameness feeling where it starts to feel very repetitive.
Yeah, how are you going to make a Minecraft 2?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, what would Minecraft 2 even be?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you could upgrade the graphics or something, but, I mean, that isn't really something that's terribly important, and it's just, I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. Subscription Minecraft, if they were hurting for money, which they're not, I could see paying for, because it's like constantly adding bits and bobs to it mm-hmm. is a valuable thing. You know, and if they were the sort that were, you know, hurting for money, then that would be like my suggested way of letting their, you know, or doing little expansions or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
but you know, adding on to the core experience, which is what we do with AI War too, mm-hmm. because it's kind of like, what would we do with a sequel that wouldn't be AI War? Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, I don't know. I'm rarely a fan of sequels in terms of the things that I create. I mean, I love like series games that kind of reinvent themselves a little bit, like Mario, Zelda, you know, Metroid, whatever. Those are finite experiences that it's okay to be a little formula driven. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they're like genre novels or something, you know, and I love that, but that's a distinct sort of a game.
Yeah. And I think this is one of the things I do like about how the industry has moved to this focus on DLCs as opposed to sequels, because you can add new stuff, you can basically add content to the experience without having to essentially create a whole new game or start from scratch. It's one of the things I like with Skyrim Collapse and how you add in a new faction, you alter like the economy of the game. So you were growing it, and the game was growing, it was new, but you didn't need to essentially, you know, recreate it from scratch again.
Right. Because people feel the need to just kind of unnecessarily tinker to go, is this different enough? I don't know. Is this different enough? You know, because like, oh, well, you know, if we're not just upgrading graphics, which, I mean, you know, that obviously happens with sequels a lot of the time. But if you're not just upgrading graphics, then what are you doing, you know? And so if you're not like changing some core stuff, which might have been perfectly fine, then you're either adding on minor stuff or just doing new content like levels or whatever. And sometimes that's worthy of a sequel and sometimes it's not. It really depends on the game. But
yeah. And in some cases, we either see one extreme where the sequel is just completely and utterly different from the first game. And as you said, it lost everything that the first game did so well. Or it's so similar to the first game that you're just wondering, you know, why do I have to spend $50-$60 on this when it's just, you know, built off of the first game.
Right. And I think I mentioned the Silent Hill games maybe earlier. Yeah. And, you know, I love Silent Hill 2. I feel like that's the pinnacle of it. That's the first one I played. And I played Silent Hill 1 and enjoyed it pretty well. And I played Silent Hill 3 and, you know, it was all right. I didn't play all the way through that one. You know, but I played Silent Hill 2 through, you know, multiple times. And then they just kept going.
And going.
And, yeah, and for the people that are super into it, fine. I have no beef with those things existing. If somebody wants more Silent Hill, and there's a market for that, by all means, make more, please. I mean, you know, with the Demon Soul, the Dark Souls 2, I have no beef with that existing. And for the people that are excited about it, that's wonderful. Everybody's doing what they should be doing. The developer, the publisher, the fans, everybody's happy. That's great. It doesn't involve me, but that's fine. The same is true for like AI War. We put out expansions. The people that are the fans of that are like, yes, give me more. I want more, more, more. And then some of the other people are like, are you crazy? I don't like the first part of it to begin with. Are you nuts? And so, you know, it's just that kind of market segmentation. And it's wonderful that we live in a time now where we can actually support that. You know, you're not having to have, you know, 20,000 games on Walmart shelves or something, you know, and nobody can find what they want, or, you know, we're actually limited to 60 titles, period, you know, on the store shelves. So you're going to get, you know, pretty slim pickings of, you know, just the biggest hits and nothing else, please. And so, you know, I love that there's this segmentation of all this stuff that I'm interested in and hardly anybody else is, but this still sells well. And that there's this stuff that I have no interest in at all, but that, you know, another segment loves. And I mean, that's great. You know, that's the market working, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I agree, though. I think that's one of the better things about the video game industry is that the games are so different or so unique that it's not a place where game companies have to directly compete with each other. It's not like you don't need to worry about what Introversion's doing with Prison Architect, or you don't need to, you know, fear the next game from Team Meat. Everyone basically has their own niche or their own design philosophy, and they can make their games and they can have their own audiences and their own niches, and it's separate in the sense that no one's directly competing, but then it's unified in the fact that all these developers can work together, they collaborate with each other, and, you know, there's no need to worry about, you know, backstabbing or any, you know, corporation-type deals that we see in other product-driven industries.
Right. I mean, pretty much the only thing that's scarce is, you know, store visibility space and attention in the press, you know, and so we compete in that sense, and that's about it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of camaraderie and sharing and so forth between indie developers, and I really love that.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with, like, novelists. There's a lot of camaraderie between novelists and stuff, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have competition, you know, for press, and they have competition for, you know, who gets the front-facing stuff or the front kiosks in bookstores. And that's about all the competition they have, too. You know, the mystery writer is not competing with the sci-fi writer.
Yeah.
Either somebody likes both, which is fine, or they like one or the other, and that's fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
Or neither.
Yeah.
But,
all right. Before we move on to our next topic, then, just one quick aside I just want to ask your opinion on, Chris, regarding sequels and whether they change or not change enough. And I was just wondering, what's your opinion on how Resident Evil shifted? This is something that I read an article about like a few weeks ago, and pretty much, in case anyone doesn't know, Resident Evil Core started out as your standard survival horror, isometric camera, similar to what the Silent Hill series was about. And then with Resident Evil 4, they just completely took it down and rebuilt it up. Came, you know, third person over the shoulder, a lot more action. And some people felt like that was, you know, the greatest game in the series. Other people felt that it just went, you know, too far. Like, it wasn't Resident Evil. So I'm just wondering, what's your opinion on that? Do you think Resident Evil was a case where the sequel went too far? Or do you think that this was sort of like a great way to basically renovate that series?
I think that the Resident Evil series is a great example of something that deserves to be a series, clearly. You know, and that's something where I lump in, like, the Far Cry series or something like that, too, where, like, I'm going to take an aside very briefly, but, like, with the Far Cry series, you've got things that, and I know a lot of people gave beef to the second one, but I really enjoyed it. Those are all, they have a different story. They give you more of what you already love, but they also give you a different spin on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, basically for somebody who already loves something and they want more of it but a little bit different, like the Far Cry series delivers. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely what you want. It's not procedural, etc. So it's not something you can just get infinite replayability about out of it. And you wouldn't want it to be procedural because the stuff that's hand-designed matters more there. So, like, the Far Cry series perfectly makes sense to be sequel after sequel. They're doing it at about the right rate, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing me back to Resident Evil, I feel like that is kind of the same thing in general. But when you've got, like, the first couple of Resident Evils, I mean, those had, like, the fixed camera angles in that really strange way. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. Silent Hill was always third-person kind of following you camera.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, Resident Evil was just that kind of fixed camera that, you know, and they exploited the camera being fixed a lot, and that was really clever at the time. But then at some point, that really started to feel kind of played, and you could argue that, okay, well, let's keep doing that anyway, because, you know, for the people that love Resident Evil, they want something that's like Far Cry, you know, let's say something that's, you know, it's more of the same thing, but a little bit different. You know,
mm-hmm.
we just keep doing what we're doing, but a little bit different stories, a little bit better graphics, whatever. And that would have been an acceptable route to go, I guess. But there comes a thing with, like, tactile games, I suppose, like Far Cry, mm-hmm. first-person shooters in general. They're super tactile.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go back to a game that you know by heart and just have fun running around shooting stuff. It's just plain fun.
Mm-hmm.
Mario, it's just fun to jump on turtles and run as fast as you can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not really the same for survival horror, you know, because the controls are usually kind of clunky on purpose and there's not a satisfaction to, you know, the movement and whatnot, really, most of the time. And so I feel like once the core idea starts getting a little played, then it's like, well, you're kind of coming to a natural end there. You're going to get increasingly niche. in a way that's probably not positive. Money aside, just artistically, it's probably not positive. And so I feel like the shift to 4 was a really positive thing. Mm-hmm. And I really love, like, the Left 4 Dead games. My wife and I still crack open those, routinely. And there again, you've got that tactile aspect to it. And it's also something we can do together, you know, cooperatively, which is really nice. But with Resident Evil 4 and onwards, you know, they brought in that tactile element. That was the big thing, mm-hmm. is they brought in that tactile element. And that was something that was missing prior to that. And so then that made it into a series that would have longevity, in my opinion. With that tactile element, you can go back to Resident Evil 4, and even though you know where the scares are, mm-hmm. even though you know what's going to happen, you know the story, it's still just satisfying to go through and do the stuff. And that is not the case for a Silent Hill game or a earlier Resident Evil game. I come back to Silent Hill 2 because there's more stuff to discover, and I like, it's like a favorite book. I want to see the story again because it was that meaningful to me. But that's unusual. You know, that's like a favorite book. You know, Silent Hill 1, I played it the one time, and that was enough, you know? So it's just, you know, you're really going to pigeonhole yourself to either having to have tentpole big successes that people come back to again and again, or, you know, go with something that has a bit of a tactile aspect to it, you know. Mm-hmm. Keith and I call that bubble wrap popping fun, you know, where, you know, regardless of whatever else is going on, there's just the satisfaction of popping some bubbles, you know, in bubble wrap as you go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that can really extend the life of a title, any title.
Yeah, I think you made a really great point with survival horror. And I think that's one of the things that has really, I think, hurt survival horror's viability in the mainstream market. Is, as you said, there's no tactile feel to these types of games. As you said, they're more for the story, but then again, that means they're just really one and done. Like, when you play, like, Silent Hill 2, I mean, it's great for the story, but unless you want to revisit that story again, there's no, like, innovative game mechanics or anything really interesting to challenge you that would make you want to replay that game over and over again compared to something, as you said, like Far Cry 2. Or I would say, like, going back to, like, Demon's Souls, that's one of those games that the combat is just so engaging and the gameplay is so challenging that it's a game that you can revisit, you know, maybe once a year or every other few years just because the gameplay is so good that even though you've, you know, seen the story a dozen times, you know how it all ends, the moment-to-moment is just so involving that you want to keep playing it.
And you really get the satisfaction from having seen your own skill evolution as mm-hmm. well. And look, I can pick this up after a year and look at me go, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, with Silent Hill 2, that's a good example of a game where there's all these little... Resident Evil doesn't do this, at least not at remotely on the level that Silent Hill 2 does. But, I mean... Silent Hill 2 has all these little hidden pieces of stuff, mm-hmm. you know, that where there's a little scrap of newspaper with some little hint of backstory that you're like, oh, wow, that casts something in a new light or whatever. Mm-hmm. And there's like, I don't remember, 4 or 6 legitimate endings and then like the 2 joke endings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they actually, you know, once you beat it once, they give you the chainsaw early on in the game, and that lets you just absolutely wreck monsters. And so... that actually is kind of cool because they kind of made it so that the kind of tedious aspect of killing monsters goes away mm-hmm. and you're a lot less threatened by the stuff that you wouldn't feel threatened by anyway. You can just kind of mow through it. But then you can kind of go into this kind of almost exploratory mm-hmm. mindset of going there. And that makes it still a finite experience, but there's still... little things that you mm-hmm. miss everywhere. And that has to do with, like, density and quality of the level design. Mm-hmm. And I felt like that wasn't up to the same standards in Silent Hills, you know, 1 or 3, and I haven't played the others. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't feel like that was there in any fashion in Resident Evil mm-hmm. at, you know. And so, there's just so many ways to make a good game. Mm-hmm. And... not every game has to be infinitely repeatable to be mm-hmm. a great game yeah. either. I mean, you know, the fact that you can't make 10 more of a Resident Evil 2 doesn't make Resident Evil 2 any less great. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, I think it just is really case by case basis. Mm-hmm. And once you pass a certain threshold in each case, you get into an increasingly niche area. Mm-hmm. The people that had beef with Far Cry 2 were the sort of people that were a little bit broader in their liking of Far Cry 1, whereas I was a lot more specific in it. I like running through the jungle, surprising guys, shooting them. I like getting in a jeep, having a rocket launcher, blowing up all the huts, and seeing the guys go flying. That's just fun. Mm-hmm. I don't care if the guards respawn. That's just more guys to shoot the next time. You know, I'm not looking for immersion or story or whatever. I like the, you know, the little castle on the hill and making my approach and dodging the snipers and then, you know, seeing what I can wreck when I get in there. That's all fun. They delivered in spades. That was just the sort of game that I was looking for. You know, repetition of some of the quests didn't matter. It just gave me some sort of reason to go shoot some stuff, you know, at, you know, more purpose than just running around aimlessly. That's all I was looking for, you know. But for somebody that was looking for more and trying to, you know, really capitalize on what was so unique about Far Cry 1, and I totally get that. Yeah, okay, they're going to be disappointed with Far Cry 2 from that perspective. Totally get that. And I think that kind of that's what we're saying here about Demon's Souls versus some of the later Dark Souls stuff, too, is that for people who feel about the later titles like I felt about Far Cry 2, what the heck's the problem? These are great games, you know? There's nothing to complain about. They're catering directly to those people. For the people that are, you know, not in that particular subgroup, you know, they're going to feel about, you know, those later titles kind of like some other folks felt about Far Cry 2, you know? Yeah. So it's just, you know, everything has its purpose in its place.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that's bad about trying to get everybody to review everything is because the people that it's really not, you know, geared towards are going to review it and kind of slam it. And it's like, well, yeah, it's really not for you, you know?
Yeah, we've definitely seen a lot of examples of that. I think my go-to example will probably be the infamous IGN review of God Hand for the PlayStation 2, where they like gave like a 1 out of 10 saying, this game is horrible because it's difficult, and I couldn't get past the first stage. And like everyone playing goes, dude, it's supposed to be difficult. That's the whole point of it.
I missed that completely, huh?
Oh, yeah, that was a fun one. I think that's when a lot of people still make fun of IGN for like completely dissing God Hand when it turned out to be, I mean, it was a very brutally difficult game, but that was the point. It was supposed to be this super tough, old-school action game.
Right.
All right. We could probably spend another few hours talking about the industry and sequels, but let's move on and go to our next topic. And we're going to talk a little bit about Nintendo as this sort of relates to the game that you've been playing this week. Right, Chris? You've been playing, of course, Super Mario 3D World.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, I've been playing Super Mario 3D World, you know, and the Donkey Kong, Tropical Freeze and so forth with my son. He's 3.5, so, you know, there's, when we're gonna game, it's gonna be, you know, family friendly sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I have a immense fondness for those sort of games to begin with. I like the ones that are sufficiently challenging, and there's some stuff at the end of the Super Mario 3D World one that is for the Wii U. I think that's the right name for it anyway. There's some stuff at the end of there that I have yet to beat those levels. They're just brutal. I mean, they remind me in some ways of Demon's Souls or whatever, where you've got these things that are just plain out going to kill you. They're not like things that pop out unexpectedly. But, you know, you're having to move at a certain speed or whatever, and you're trying to process what's happening as you go, and you're like, man, look at all these little holes, and there's charging chucks coming after me, and if I stop moving, I fall through the holes, and oh, man, now I have to turn down to go here, and oh, shoot, I was over the hole, so of course I fell through it. That wasn't smart, you know. And so you're going through this whole thing, and you're like, man, I've got to, you know, replay this a bunch of times to get through there, and you know, so I'll do that as often as my son will let me, and then we'll go play, you know, some other levels and, you know, make progress on beating them with different characters and stuff, and just play them for the fun of it and stuff like that. And the Donkey Kong Country ones are, the new ones, the Returns ones are wonderfully difficult. Mm-hmm. They're in the sense that they're not like over the top crazy, mm-hmm. but they offer sufficient challenge on every level that they're quite entertaining. And they give you just like tons of life balloons, which is kind of amusing to me too. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a good enough player that I wind up having like 70 plus lives at all times, and yet I'm dying constantly. Yeah. And so it's kind of amusing that those two things go hand in hand somehow in that game. It's just kind of funny. But, you know, those have been very, Nintendo's always, and, you know, I think it's Retro Studios doing the Donkey Kong one, mm-hmm. but, you know, they always just have a really good sense of design that I always really appreciate.
Mm-hmm. I think it's funny you compared Super Mario 3 World to Demon's Souls, as I actually wrote an article a few years ago where I actually did the same thing with Mario Galaxy to Demon's Souls. And how the skill level or the mastery of the mechanics were similar in both games. As you said, both games test you on how you basically grasp the mechanics and how you apply them to the situation at hand.
Yeah, I can totally see that, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Super Mario Galaxy 2 mm-hmm. really expanded yeah. on that. And, you know, it's one of those things where I really enjoyed that, but it wasn't as innovative as the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that was a great sequel to me.
Yeah.
And I think that since I'm so squarely in that target audience, here again, it's that thing where, you know, mm-hmm. if you had the sort of feelings about Demon's Souls that I had about Mario Galaxy, mm-hmm. then you're all about the Dark Souls, mm-hmm. and nobody's going to convince you that it's inferior or whatever. You yeah. don't care. And I do feel that Mario Galaxy 2 was inferior in some ways. It wasn't as innovative and whatever. I recognize yeah. that. But it was also harder, mm-hmm. and I like that
yeah.
because I had totally mastered Mario Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted stuff that was harder. That was all that I wanted. You know,
yeah.
give me stuff that's new and that is harder. And they did, and I was happy.
Oh, hell yeah. I think I did like 100% or... Yeah, I definitely 100% both Mario Galaxy and Mario Galaxy 2. I just love those games. And as yeah. you said earlier, one thing about Nintendo is that they are like the genre novels. I mean, in the sense that if you love Mario, you're going to love, you know, the next Mario, next Mario Galaxy, whatever. And that's always been, I think, one of Nintendo's key strengths, is that their franchises are so integrated into their game design. So if you yeah. like action-adventure, you're going to love, you know, pick a Zelda game, you're going to love it. If you like platforming, you know, any Mario platformer, you're going to enjoy that, as they really, you know, hone that type of design.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, like Mario Kart is something that's really interesting, too. I've actually been playing a lot of that, too. Mario Kart 7, I'm trying to 100% that. I'm trying to get triple stars and everything. I've got at least one star and everything. But, again, I'm playing that with my son. And I think one of the really interesting things about the Mario Kart games is that they change the physics slightly every time. The exact timing of when you need to push, you know, the gas
mm-hmm.
In order to get the boost on the start is a little different in every game. Exactly how the slides work and so forth is a little bit different in every game. And I know they do that on purpose because it makes it so that there's an adjustment period.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you were a master of the prior Mario Kart, which anybody mm-hmm. who played it to death would be, you're going to be a little off on the new one for a while, and there's going to be a learning period again.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you go back to the one from before, now you're a little off on that
yeah.
one, you know. And I think that's brilliant. You know, it's totally appropriate because, you know, for the people that are fans of that as a series, they don't just get worn out. And mm-hmm. at the same time, the people that are coming new aren't having to get some sort of insane challenge that only someone that played the first six Mario Karts could possibly cope with,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, I really look forward to seeing how they're expanding that in Mario Kart 8. I'm mm-hmm. super excited about that coming up. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's just Nintendo really is very smart about how they manage their franchises.
Yeah, definitely. And I know earlier we talked about how annoying sequels can be, but I think for me, Nintendo is still one of those few companies where I do love to see sequels to their games. I mean, we just said how much we love Mario Galaxy 1 and 2. And I mean, the next Smash Brothers game, chances are if I have a Wii U by then, I'm going to buy that as well. because as you said, their design is just so well, and they know just how to make it to keep it fresh, or at least push it in a new direction while adhering to what made the previous one so popular.
Right. It's not even that I'm annoyed by sequels, per se. It's just that a game that trades on its uniqueness,
mm-hmm.
if you don't make a new game that trades on different uniqueness in some fashion,
mm-hmm.
If it doesn't have some sort of other hook, like, you know, okay, new levels that are all hand-designed and more difficulty and mm-hmm. some new mechanics, Mario Galaxy 2, there's the hook.
Yeah.
You know, Far Cry 2, more bubble wrap popping fun of mm-hmm. shooting guys and more explodey things, mm-hmm. you know, and new level design. That was the hook.
Mm-hmm.
We're done. You know, but if there's not some sort of new hook, really, and let's be, you know, like the Resident Evil stories or something, you know, in the mm-hmm. first ones, I mean, you know, they weren't, like, so compelling that that would be a hook by itself. And so I run into kind of sequel annoyance when there's a sequel just because.
Yeah.
Not because there was a reason, but mm-hmm. but just because. You know, and like the Call of Duty sequels, I'm not bothered by those. I don't buy them. I don't mm-hmm. play Call of Duty. But I'm not bothered by those in any way because I feel like those do serve a purpose. I mean, mm-hmm. it's kind of subscription content in sort of a way of like, here's your, you know, it takes time and money to build mm-hmm. the new maps and all the various stuff. And, you know, I played Counter-Strike for years, and if there had been a yearly new edition of Counter-Strike, I would not have blinked an eye at buying a new one of that. And, you know, I played Unreal Tournament to death and then was so excited about Unreal Tournament 2003, and it was great. And then 2004, that was great. And then they stopped making those, mm-hmm. and I was like, where'd all those go? And, you know, mm-hmm. I was annoyed that they stopped giving. And I was like, yeah, maybe bring a new one every year. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm all for it, you know? But, I mean, those were things that had, again, the tactile stuff, and they were warranted. And I guess it just comes down to the market. I'm not mm-hmm. saying that Demon's Souls 2 or Dark Souls 2 or Dark Souls 1 is not warranted.
Mm-hmm.
That would be really unfair of me to say. Yeah. And just that would be like the sort of people that go, AI War is a terrible game and shouldn't exist because I don't like it. Mm-hmm. That's just wrongheaded.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, mm-hmm. it is a case where the appeal grows
mm-hmm.
more and more niche with it in some games and doesn't with others, you know.
Yeah. And that's another good point that we've talked about on previous casts, and that the best games that we've seen, you can always tell a game that was made either for profit, you know,
yeah.
focus groups and all that, versus a game that was made because someone really, really wanted to make that game or wanted to, you know, make something inspired by an older game. It's the same thing that we're seeing a lot with crowdfunding and Kickstarter, you know, pulling that nostalgia to say, you know, hey, did you like the City Builders in 1994? Well, we're going to make a game like that now. You know, donate to us if you want something more like that.
Right. Absolutely. And there's some big companies doing that, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got, like, the Mass Effect games and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they needed three games. It was a trilogy.
Yeah.
It was something that was totally warranted every bit of it.
Yeah.
And you could tell that they loved what they were making.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. You know, if they started making yearly side plots for it
mm-hmm.
that were kind of phoned in, then it would start feeling like some of the Star Wars stuff that is kind of phoned in.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was, you know, yeah. So it's just, I love seeing that passion, whether it's at a big company or a small, and it's way more common with the small, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you can always tell.
Yeah. And I guess another example I'm hearing some news about now is the new Spider-Man movie that I think it's either out or it's coming out. That a lot of people say that it's just not that good. That you can tell, as we said, you can really tell that this wasn't made because someone wanted to tell a Spider-Man story. They, of course, made it because they won the money. And there's the whole deal that Sony has that they have to keep making these movies or they lose the IP. It goes back to Marvel.
Yeah, I think they were saying they wanted to make, like, a Spider-Man or Spider-Man-related movie every year.
Ugh.
And I was just like, oh my god. You know, I really liked Spider-Man 1 and 2, and then don't get me started on Spider-Man 3. And then I didn't even have any desire to see the new Spider-Man because I just,
mm-hmm.
nothing about it appealed to me. Like, the new Amazing Spider-Man 1 and then 2, yeah. I thought it was really funny, the movie poster. We were going to see something else, I think Hunger Games or something, and it was like his greatest foe is yet to, you know, is he's going to fight it. And it's him sitting on a skyscraper looking out at the city, and the biggest element in the screen is sky. And all there is Spider-Man, a city, and sky. Sky is three quarters. I'm like, what is his greatest enemy? The sky? And it's just like, it's just like, okay. Effective poster guy.
Yeah.
Totally an aside, but I just thought it was very funny.
Mm-hmm. I saw the first one. I had to rent because I didn't want to spend money in the movie. I saw it. And I mean, the first hour, I mean, it felt like you could just completely cut 1 hour out of that movie and nothing would have really changed.
Yeah.
I almost fell asleep watching that, which is always good in an action movie when you start to get tired of them talking for an hour straight. Bringing this back to Nintendo, one thing that I want to touch on that you said a few minutes ago was regarding the difficulty, as this is something that I always find very interesting about Nintendo, and a little bit one of the problems they've had, I think, keeping their mainstream or maybe their core gamers happy. And that is one of the things I've noticed a lot with some of their more popular series, like Mario, Pokemon, etc., is that they tend to skew more towards younger audiences in the sense that they always start with a basic tutorial. Their level designs start out very simple, very basic. Like there's never really a quote-unquote bite. And I think it's very great when we see Nintendo sort of give some of that bite back, where they make something challenging. Like we talk about with Mario Galaxy and Mario Galaxy 2. Like some of those final worlds in Mario Galaxy 2, they were freaking hard. I mean,
yeah.
They were freaking hard for someone like me who 100% the first game. So
yeah.
So that was a great example of Nintendo basically saying, you know what, we're going to take the gloves off. Let's make something hard for someone.
And they've really hit on something there with those kind of, you die 8 times and a little block comes up mm-hmm. that you can hit and, you know, skip it. You know, and for the people that are, you know, hardcore, they're like, I'm not hitting that block.
Yeah, right here.
Keep that thing away from me, you know. You know, I'll reset if I hit it by accident, you know, yeah. But... But for everybody else, it's like, okay, I'm sick of this level, let me pass. And I think some of the mistakes that they were making with some of their middle-older
yeah.
stuff, back to like New Super Mario Bros. 1 and I think New Super Mario Bros. Wii, the first one, was that they were only letting you save every time you got like to a castle or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Like halfway through a world, basically, or every time you unlocked a door. Once you beat the game, then you could save whenever you wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was really a mistake because it skewed towards, trying to make it.
Or
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. It skewed towards being punitive in a way that was not productive for anybody. Because if you're hardcore, you're not going to run into needing to save more often unless you're just, I need to stop right now. It's time to go to, you know, make dinner or whatever, you know? And it's like, great, now I've got to either find a door to unlock because I've saved up some coins, or I've just got to redo it tomorrow, or I've got to leave the Wii on, whatever. You know, for somebody, you know, like my in-laws have been playing it, and they got, like, incredibly frustrated at having to play the same levels
yeah.
over and over again because they kept getting knocked back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that right there is one of like, the worst things you can ever do in a game is force someone to replay content that they've already beaten due to, you know, some arbitrary reason.
Yeah. And so they've stopped doing that with the newer ones, I'm pretty sure. I don't die a whole lot with
mm-hmm.
the first playthrough, so I don't always notice.
Mm-hmm.
But the, you know, they've started making it so that you don't have to worry about, yeah, it saves after every level on, like, the Mario 3D World. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you're not going to have to replay something unless you want to, and it's compelling enough that you do want to. And they try and hide in enough stuff that it's compelling to actually, you know, complete.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 3 or 4 worlds in the Mario 3D Land, 3D World
mm-hmm.
one are, you know, they're pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
And the last one world, I have beaten one of the 3 levels in there yet so far, and it's
mm-hmm.
just, you know, I, you know, like I said, if my 3-year-old would let me, I would keep at it more and get to it. But he's like, no, let's not play that one right now, because he gets tired of watching the daddy fall down a hole, you know, like 100 times in a row. But, you know, so, I mean, I think it's something where they've kind of figured out that balance a bit, you know, of don't be punitive to the players that aren't good. Give the players that aren't good a pass. Give the challenge there, not right away, you know, so you don't, you know, that was like one thing with like Demon Souls, was there's like no time to like get in at all and like feel like you had a foothold on anything. There was no ramp up. It was just like boot to the face immediately.
Yeah, they just like drop you in there and say, okay, enjoy, have fun, you know, see you later.
Yeah. And a lot of people will make comments about my games being that way in certain fashions too. If you're making a certain kind of hardcore game, there's a certain degree of inevitability to that. Mm-hmm. That first Demon's Souls level is a teaching level, as you alluded to, but it's teaching you with the boot to the face.
Yeah.
And Nintendo couldn't do that, you know. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they couldn't make Demon's Souls, period, with the sort of audience that they have, you know. Mm-hmm. So they've kind of hit the right mix, but it's just, you know, different tool, you know, different tools for different trades, really.
Mm-hmm. And I think with Nintendo, with their difficulty, I think as you said, that it's great how, on one hand, it starts out simple. They're not going, you know, like the first level of Mario games, usually like, you know, a flat area, there's no pits, something to test your skill on or test, put your feet in the water type deal. But then as you said, when you get to the end or you get to the bonus stuff, then it's like they're punching you in the face with difficulty. And you talked about earlier with the skip level, like, I think it's like a star that you unlock. I remember when I accidentally did that in Super Mario Galaxy 1, and I accidentally hit yes and they beat the level for me. I was so ashamed of myself. I was like, you know, you're going to beat this level. You're not stopping until you do that and get the real star.
That was like my favorite Penny Arcade comic of all time, if you know what I'm talking about, where they did one, you know, parodying that, and Mario's like, oh man, I wasn't doing that bad, was I? You know, it's like, you can do it, buddy, jump all the way to the top. So, and that just cracks me up every time. Oh man. But yeah.
Now, with Nintendo, I'm wondering, have you played either Kid Icarus Uprising or the latest Zelda, the Link Between Worlds?
Oh, I've not played the Kid Icarus one, but the Link Between Worlds, I have 100%ed, I think, basically 1.5 times. That was an incredibly incredible game. Oh man,
yeah, that was one of my favorite games of last year. And I think what I love the most about it, as I said a few minutes ago, was this was Nintendo really taking the gloves off. There was no tutorial, there's no little fairy saying, hey, listen, 2,700 times. Basically saying, you know, here's the Zelda world, these are some places you have to go, enjoy. Go where you want, do what you want. And my favorite part of that was, the first time I played through, I completely miss how you upgrade weapons. Yeah, the first time I played through, I mean, I got the sword, of course, because that was a quest, but, you know, unlocking, like, the enhanced hook, enhanced boomerang, I completely missed.
You weren't collecting Mimis.
I was collecting them, but I didn't go back to the person. I thought it was, like, one of those old quests where you had to collect them all before you get a reward. The second time I went in there, I was like, wait, I get these upgrade items now? And I completely missed the dash boots. And my favorite part of that was, after I figured out what you had to do, it was such like a hit-in-the-head moment. It's like, yeah, it makes sense now, but I was so expecting like some, you know, completely obtuse solution for how you get the boots from the guy that I didn't think of, you know, the simplest way of doing that. I was like, was it.
that fifth bottle, for one, I wasn't expecting a fifth bottle, but I also, that was another one of those things where I couldn't figure out how to get to that stupid chest in, you know, the empty house where Link's house is in the Lowell. And I was like, well, maybe that's a decorative chest. It's not a decorative chest. I know I can get it. How do I get it? You know, and then it's like, oh, stupid. You know, the solution was actually really stupid simple. But, you know, I didn't figure that out till the second playthrough. Mm-hmm. And again, yeah, I didn't figure out the dash boots either. I don't remember, till the second playthrough or at all or something. I mean, or until late in the first one. I'm not sure. But it took a while. And And yeah, there was just so many little side things to find and all that. I was really disappointed when it was done, where I was just like, this has some tactile fun, but I've kind of worn this out. And, you know, so that's why I said I think 100%ed it like a time and a half, because about the halfway through the second one where I'd beaten it, but I'd gotten most of 100%, I was like, yeah, I think I'm done. Oh, yeah, and it had that hero mode thing where that was brutal, and I loved it.
Yeah, me too. It was the first time I ever played a Zelda game twice on that hero mode, and that kicked my ass. I mean, for the first time, I actually died in a Zelda game through combat. It was like, oh my god, this a Zelda game that's hard? What is this madness?
Oh man, you didn't play the Master Quest thing for Ocarina of Time?
I played it, but I don't think I played it all the way through. I think I got that around the time I was still playing the original. I got like the GameCube compilation disc. I never sat down to play the whole thing.
Ah, yeah, that was something that I really enjoyed. And yeah, and the original two Zeldas were both filled with plenty of hard stuff. But yeah, beyond those, it was not really.
Yeah, the reason I brought up Kid Icarus, because I think this was done by, I forget his name, he's a developer who created the Smash Brothers series.
I can't remember his name.
I think his last name was Sakurai, something like that.
Well, yeah.
What was so great about that was it was a game where you could basically, you set the difficulty of each level before you play it on a scale of 0 to 10. 4 is considered normal. And then every point you go higher than that, it raises the difficulty up, but then it unlocks higher quality items that you can find in the level. And I thought it was such a brilliant idea of, it was like one of the few Nintendo games where you could start the game at, you know, super hard challenge. Or you could, you know, lower the difficulty, like, if you weren't good at the game. But I felt that that was one of those examples of Nintendo really giving the best of both worlds. It could be this casual experience, or it could be this brutally difficult game that's going to kick your ass until you learn it. But I think...
Wow, that's really good. That makes me want to play it.
Yeah. The only thing is, if you're left-handed, that game is a nightmare to play for lefties. Because of how you need the circle pad. Like, it's so weirdly set up, and if you have like the big 3DS, like the larger model, the XL, it doesn't fit on that stand, so it was such a pain to play. But it was almost worth it for just how interesting the game design was compared to other Nintendo games. I would say one last example then, the Kirby games, I think, have always been very interesting in, as we said, hiding the difficulty or hiding the challenge. Have you ever played Canvas Curse for the DS?
Yeah, and that was the first one I thought of when you mentioned difficulty. Yeah.
And for people who don't know, it was a game where you basically drew the path that Kirby would roll along the level. And the basic way through was, you know, ridiculously easy, you know, something a child could do. But then they had all these, they had basically three, I think, medals or coins hidden each level. And these were always around, you know, difficult puzzles. You had to be really careful how you maneuver. And that
You only had so much so much ink, and you would have to tap enemies with some of it and to stop them. And you could accelerate yourself with how you drew your lines. Yeah.
But yeah, that's another great example of, I love it, and I said this before, I love when Nintendo takes those gloves off. When they want to challenge you, Nintendo can make some really challenging gameplay.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was a little disappointed about with, I enjoyed New Super Mario Bros. Wii U, but I was a little disappointed in it that the secret coins and stuff were actually kind of easy to get. I actually found that game brutally hard, where nobody normally would, because there's a thing that you can, you know, there's that special feature where like somebody can kind of cheat and help you with like making blocks or whatever. Well, give that to a 3-year-old and it becomes like one of the hardest Mario games ever, because like you never know when like a block is going to pop up, like right as you're in the middle of a jump across a pit, and you're like, oh crap. And so it's like, all right, wall jump off that block. Ah, damn it, block right above me. All right, let's see, I'm in the hole, wall jump back and forth. I can get out of this hole, I can get out of this hole. Like, oh, block right ahead of me. Dang it. You know, and it's like, all right, well, let's try that again. And it's like, this just kind of, you know, it's it's better than like computer random harassment. You know, it's just like that was pretty entertaining. That made my enjoyment for that particular title. I think I would have really been frustrated with that title had it not been for my son. But and of course, you know, he's like, I'm helping, I'm tapping Mario, you know, this is fun, you know. But and sometimes it'd be like, okay, tap right here so daddy can jump on the block and get up to there, you know. And but most of the time it was quite the menace.
Mm-hmm. But, it almost sounds like we almost like Demon Souls. The developers are creating these little traps to stop you.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's just like, yeah, you're running along and then suddenly, blam, back in the face. And it's just like, oh, man. Hope you weren't over a hole. Of course you were over a hole.
All right. Before we move on then to our final topic, one last question I want to ask you, Chris, about your thoughts on Nintendo. And that has to do with some of the difficulties Nintendo has had, at least this generation with the Wii U. And we've talked about this on previous casts, that Nintendo has had a really hard time basically reacquiring their core game. They've been considered third place now for two generations. Some could arguably say since the GameCube era when PlayStation 2 and Xbox came along. So I'm wondering for you, Chris, as a longtime Nintendo fan, what are your thoughts on, I guess, a lot of difficulties and a lot of people have been throwing, you know, doom and gloom at Nintendo over like the last year with the Wii U?
I always find it amusing, the whole thing of like, who won E3 or whatever, you know, because it's like, you know, Xbox 360 captured the bulk of the market, mm-hmm. you know, versus the PS3, fine. You know, I have a PS3, and I have a, you know, we had a Wii, now I have a Wii U, gave the Wii to parents-in-law. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's one of those things, these guys are all making loads of money. Everybody's staying employed in the main. They're not having, like, studio closures like some of these third-party mm-hmm. studios are. They're still making titles that their core fans on whichever system we're talking about here are into. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, various console makers are taking various losses on various hardware that they're making. I mean, you know, they all take losses on hardware for a while at various points, it seems mm-hmm. like. Not. And, you know, so it's kind of like, all right, if this wasn't a publicly traded company, mm-hmm. nobody would care, you know? Mm-hmm. When it's a publicly traded company, it becomes a different thing because mm-hmm. it's like, oh, well, you know, you always want the numbers to be going up. Mm-hmm. Even if where you were before was like rainbows and puppies amazing and dropping down a bit is just amazing, mm-hmm. you know, oh, sorry, you know, we're down 10 puppies. We've only got 1,000 puppies now, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, you know, that then makes your stock take a hit and everybody's doom and gloom and unhappy. But in the reality of it, you know, if it was a privately held company, it's like everybody still has their jobs. We're all still making money hand over fist mm-hmm. in the main. What's to complain about yeah. sort of thing. It does, you know, create concerns with something that's publicly held. I'm not an expert on that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't really know how to comment on that. But, you know, from where I'm sitting, if I was Nintendo, I'd be pretty happy. Mm-hmm. Winning the console wars is partly luck, partly catering to a certain demographic, you know, so forth. And, you know, Nintendo's made their choice. They're not catering to all the hardcore gamers. They're catering to some. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for myself with my company, too, mm-hmm. I'm not competing with some of, you know, mm-hmm. like Notch or something. He has a very wide net, you know, with Minecraft, and mm-hmm. there's very few people that are like even like kind of competing with that, you know, mm-hmm. or like Angry Birds or something. Mm-hmm. They're not in any way a competitor mm-hmm. because the sort of people that like either one of those games may very well include the bulk of the people that also like my games because everybody loves that stuff. Fine, mm-hmm. I like both as well. But at the same time, that doesn't take anything away from me. And it's also a case of where I'm serving a certain market niche that nobody else is serving.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Nintendo has,
mm-hmm.
is that nobody else is making or can make Mario and Zelda games.
Yeah.
They can't do it because of the franchises themselves. You know, mm-hmm. you cannot use Mario. But at the same time, even with the franchises that try and kind of imitate it, you know, I won't name any names, but there's imitation Marios mm-hmm. and Zeldas and so on.
Mm-hmm.
They freaking stink compared to what Nintendo does. Mm-hmm. Nintendo just knows their stuff, you know, when it comes to that sort of thing. And so there's always going to be kind of that core market that comes back and they buy the Wii U or whatever console. So they can buy, like, the 5 Nintendo first-party titles that they want to play with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the cost of getting those 5 titles, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, it makes it a little bit of a premium experience compared to, you know, if you're buying, like, 30 PlayStation 4 games or something. But there's plenty of people that are on, you know...
Mm-hmm.
PlayStation, that it's their Call of Duty box. They buy a PlayStation, mm-hmm. and then they buy Call of Duty, and then they buy Call of Duty again. And, you know, and that's cool, too, or the mm-hmm. Xbox with the Halo machine, basically, you know?
Yeah, or you can, like, Madden. I mean, I've heard people who have the dedicated Madden box.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, nobody thinks to really criticize, like, Microsoft or Sony for those, because they also have... I mean, why would you? Because they've also got all this other sort of stuff. And Nintendo kind of just has that mm-hmm. and not the other broader third-party support. And so it's a little more stark there, and the market's a little smaller. But it's still, from all evidence, a really thriving, healthy market. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always the grass is greener, trying to keep up with the Joneses or whatever. But, I, you know, that's... kind of an unhealthy way to look at things, really. And I mean, if I was an investor, like, trying to decide where to put my stock, first of all, I wouldn't be investing in video game companies to begin with, of that sort of scope. But I don't know which one of those I would pick, you know, because, mm-hmm. you know, Nintendo's stock would fluctuate based on, you know, the whims of people that are going, oh, you're not in first place or whatever. But at the same time, they've got this, you know, captive audience that is steady revenue versus, like, Sony and Microsoft are huge, but at the same time, they're, like, always battling it out, and their audience is not quite so captive. They fluctuate back and forth.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's just kind of like, you know, who's really in the strongest position? You could argue about that some, you know?
Yeah, and that is an excellent point. Another thing we talk about and what a lot of people say is that Nintendo's strength is in their originality. Yeah, and I think that's a good point. As you said, with Nintendo games, no one is going to basically make another Mario or a Zelda game. That is exclusively Nintendo. And I think one of their strengths should be not aiming for number one. Because as you said, you know, winner of the year, winner of E3, is such a wishy-washy type title that it's hard to really get. That they should
it's transient.
Yeah. Like, what does being winner of E3 get you? Do you get, you know, the gold key, you get 1 month of, you know, criticism-free reviews?
Yeah, really.
But they should really aim to be number two. They should be the system that you should buy because you can't get those games anywhere else. And I think it's interesting that you said about how they have that premium. This past holiday, I was looking at buying Nintendo games, and Nintendo games rarely depreciate in value. We've talked about this a lot, and how a lot of games, you know, we see a lot of $60 games drop to $30, or they drop to $10, or whatever, but Nintendo games rarely dip. I mean, I still see, you know, Super Mario Galaxy 2 selling for $40, $50, and they're a couple years old at this point. And
2008,
yeah.
Super Mario Galaxy 1, it blew my mind, but yeah.
And it's still like $40, $50, you know, retail. Or it may have gone to Nintendo's, they had, you know, like that special brand for classic games where they drop it down to $20. But mm-hmm. still, it takes forever for a Nintendo game to depreciate. And I think that's because, as you said, they're so unique. When you buy a brand new Zelda or a brand new Mario game, sure, it's that same gameplay that you've gotten used to. But it's such at a level of quality that you really don't see from other companies.
Yeah, and you know, they also, I think, it's important that they don't depreciate, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of hardcore gamers that just don't jump on the bandwagon immediately, because why would you? Mm-hmm. They don't have enough launch titles that are typically interesting. And so I don't think I got a Wii U until mm-hmm. maybe shortly before Super Mario 3D World came out. And, you know, whatever the Zelda is that comes out for Wii U, I'll be excited for that. You know, and Mario Kart 8 is coming, and mm-hmm. they had, you know, New Super Mario Brothers to Wii U to whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was fun. And the Donkey Kong one, you know, so this whole list of things at this point. And so it's kind of hitting its stride where it's like, all right, now there's like 5, 6, 7 games that I want to play that are either out or going to be out mm-hmm. soon. There was no really point in getting one until there were like 3 that I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. You know, I can wait. You know, I don't have a shortage of things to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and I think that there's a lot of people with that kind of attitude, and you wind up with seeing a little price drop too on the console itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
yeah.
Hey, all right, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
I didn't buy my 3DS until at least, I think, a year after it actually came out. Because, one, I was waiting for games to come, and I was also waiting for the bigger models. I felt that would have been a lot easier to look through. So I tried the original model at, like, a kiosk at GameStop, and it started giving me, like, a little headache trying to play that in 3D. But for some reason, the bigger screen is not bothering me. I can look at the much larger screen with the 3D effect. At least I can keep it at half on. And I can at least play without, you know, feeling like someone's drilling into my head.
Right. I mostly play with 3D off because I'm almost always playing with my son.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's under 6 and
yeah.
really only one person can look at it anyway. But I think I bought it about a year after it came out, too. I forget for what game. But, you know, I got the smaller model and then the bigger model came and I was like, yeah, okay. But I got that one, too. So then my wife would have one and I would have one and... You know, so that, but yeah.
And the Wii U is definitely on my list of things to buy at some point. I'm just waiting for a big enough sale. And then, as you said, when I do eventually buy the Wii U, I'm going to have, you know, 6, 7 titles right off the bat that I'm probably going to have to play just for it.